And a very good morning to you live from London. You're with Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up, my panellists Letika Burke and Steve Kinnane will be dissecting the week's main stories. It's an Australian mafia invasion. Letika, what have you spotted?
Emma, good morning. Looking at the wash-up from French President Emmanuel Macron's visit to China alongside Ursula von der Leyen, the EU president, and found a very interesting story in Manchester of a musical gone wrong.
Steve, what have you found?
Something from Medusa, the independent Russian media outlet in exile in Latvia, suggesting that Russian prisoners recently recruited by the Ministry of Defence to fight in Ukraine are now going to serve 18-month contracts on the front line if they last that long.
Brilliant. Thank you. We'll hear from that. We'll also get the latest from Finland, from Petri Burtsov, and we'll be heading to Portugal to talk donkeys with our editorial director, Tyler Brille. So lots to look forward to. It's the 9th of April, 2023. Happy Easter. Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday with Emma Nelson.
Not just a happy Easter to you, but happy Easter to my panellists as well. Letika Burke, journalist of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and Steve Kinnane, Europe Bureau Chief for ABC. Australia has arrived at Midori House.
Indeed.
And it's not Andrew Muller.
He's been displaced.
You're making a land grab. How's it going? Happy Easter. How's it going?
Happy Easter. You know, I didn't even realise it was Easter.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I'm one of those, because journalists don't get public holidays, right? So I just
carry I got Good
working.
Friday off.
Do you?
Yeah.
What does it feel like, Steve?
It feels very weird. You only get Good Friday and Christmas Day off.
Yeah,
we have to
right.
work public holidays, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I
don't mind. I just carry on working, but it always does amuse me when people say, what are you doing for Easter? I'm like, what? There's a holiday coming up?
What are the plans for Easter Day today then? Work, or something fun?
No, work, exercise and enjoy this beautiful sunshine that's finally arrived in London. 17 degrees in London today, and I know that that's an embarrassment for me as an Australian to be celebrating and reveling in a temperature that's not even got a 2 in front of it.
Yeah, I might go full English. I might go to a common and take my shirt off.
You're going to get naked like the natives.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us which common it is and I'll tell everybody. Let's head to somewhere hopefully warm and sunny, full of good cheer at least. Our editorial director, Tyler Brille. The latest instalment of Tyler's travels. He's currently in Portugal. Are you there, Tyler? Very good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Emma. Bom dia. Nice to hear from you and happy Easter to you.
And how is Easter in Portugal?
Well, Easter in Portugal, I think there might be a 3 in front of the temperature today. I'm in Alentejo in São Lourenço de Barrocal, a wonderful centuries old family estate turned hotel looking out over the vineyards, the olive groves, the cork trees. You can hear the bird song in the background, hopefully, and it's going to be delightful. But I think it might hit 31 degrees inland. We're about, maybe 30 kilometres just west of the Spanish border here.
I think you're probably quite glad you're not in the studio at the moment, because there are some pretty mean faces being pulled when you describe that scene. I mean, dare I ask what takes you to such a place?
Well, this is, of course, as you said, it's Tyler's Travels. It's off the back of a 10-day tour from Asia, of course, which we've been checking in from over the past few weeks. So this was a moment to, of course, just have a few days off, of course, combined with a little bit of work as well. So it'll be back up to Lisbon tomorrow morning for a couple of meetings and then heading back to Zurich just in time for some other events. But we'll talk about those a little bit later.
And I think what we need to get straight to the point was, as I mentioned a moment ago when we were just starting the programme off, that you have a burning issue with donkeys, that this is a new thing. Now, on Monocle on Sunday, I think we can widely accept, has a sort of a happy family, animal-friendly theme occasionally to it. But it's predominantly been a goat-related narrative that we've been going for. Tyler, you're about to change all that, aren't you?
Well, listen, this is not a huge or maybe it's not a new revelation in more inner circles. But I've always had a fondness for donkeys as well. As you've said, there's been much more goat coverage, certainly on Monocle Radio over the past few years, certainly on this particular program. But at this hotel, one of the features is a wonderful set of stables, and then there's sort of the star of the four-legged show here, which is Geronimo the donkey, who has a wonderful paddock, and just is really sort of a fixture. So yesterday they had a cart hooked up to him, and he was sort of parading around the grounds of the property, taking kids on Easter egg hunts. I believe the same thing, of course, this being Easter Sunday, he's going to have to go out and do the rounds as well. But he's a complete delight, and it's just interesting how one animal becomes a bit of a defining feature for a hotel, which has, of course, wonderful land and a great kitchen, amazing vineyard, many, many other things. But somehow the donkey has become the mascot of this property, and I have to probably pay a visit at least 5 times a day when I'm here.
Oh, lovely. Are you going for a little trip on the back of Geronimo's cart, or are you just sort of leaving?
No, I don't think so. I will observe from afar, and if you're lucky, I will send you a film though, Emma.
I can't wait. What's quite nice about this, I mean, we had Latika a moment ago saying that, as a working journalist, bank holidays, public holidays don't figure. Clearly Geronimo has to step up as well in times of high days and holidays.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think that this is one of his big shining moments. I'm not sure what happens at Christmas time, but it's interesting. I referenced this in my column today. When I was flying to Dubai a few weeks ago, I managed to see the Academy Award nominated film, EO, a Polish film about a donkey, which is it's a rather dark 90 minutes, almost 2 hours. Where you spend time with this donkey in Poland and his travels as well, and it's all seen through the eyes of the donkey. But you notice in that film that actually donkeys, aside from the human interaction, they are beasts of burden, and they do like work. And this is sort of part of what comes out of this film as well, as this animal becomes untethered from his daily life. How things go a little bit wrong when he goes out on the road.
My goodness. I mean, they say that altitude makes you cry, but did this make you cry, Tyler?
Oh, a total complete tearjerker. I mean, absolutely. As we know, 36,000 feet, tears come on very easily for most people. But this is one where you want to make sure that you're somehow ensconced with some kind of business class buffer around you, so you can have a good old ball in the background.
It's absolutely lovely. I wonder whether there'll be a sort of a, well, I mean, look, the donkey is clearly having an enormous influence on you at the moment. Will we be seeing elements of that sort of stitched into to Monocle in the next few weeks and months? I know we have an owl mascot, Monochan. Does Monochan need to worry that his lunch is just about to be eaten by Geronimo?
No, I don't think he has too much to worry about, but maybe there's never been a donkey at the petting zoo when come Christmas time, and who knows, maybe we need to also have a petting zoo, because we've been talking about doing an event, a Monocle spring or summer event at Midori House, so maybe we should be thinking about something, a pair of donkeys, 3 donkeys, whatever may keep the kids happy, of course, you and me as well, Emma.
Yes.
So we'll see if we can make it happen for summer. If not, donkeys definitely in the Monocle Christmas manger.
A donkey derby down Manchester Street is what I'm looking to see, complete with bunting. It would obviously be a new and fresh thing, as has, dare I say, quite a fun week here at Monocle Radio.
Yeah, I listen. It's I've been sort of obviously darting here and there, but I was going to ask you, how's it been settling in with the new jingles? Of course, Monocle 24, no longer as a brand and reinvented as Monocle Radio. So how's it been for you?
It's been really good fun. There's a nice fresh sound. There's a nice fresh feeling. There is that slight nervousness on the tip of the tongue that I'm going to say the old name of the radio station, because dare I say it, I actually have said the name Monocle 24 probably more times in my life than I've actually said the name of my own husband. So it was quite a bit of a challenge, but a bit of self-consciousness and a little bit of grit. And it's been just delightful doing Monocle Radio. And it's really good to be on an editorial floor when you suddenly think, OK, we're refreshed, we're branded. OK, we're pretty much committed 24/7 anyway. But when you have that sort of, we've given it a lick of paint, we've rearranged everything, it seems fresh. It's been really, really good fun. And it's been good fun on the Globalist as well. Georgina Godwin and I presented in the same studio, in the same room, for the first time in Monocle's history.
Which is quite a feat as well. But I have to say that there's been a lot of fantastic response. The work that we've done with one part of the Quiet Nights Orchestra from Stockholm, the Blue Toucan in France, who also worked on our end of hours, our new 59s, as we call them, as well, has just been fantastic to also read all of the response.
Yeah, lovely and fresh sounding. Let's talk about where you are in Portugal. And there always has to be the question, how is business there in Portugal? Because Portugal always seems to have a bit of a glint in its eye when it knows to sort of do things right and do things well. What's your take on what's happening?
Well, certainly, one of the main stories, if you pick up any of the papers here at the moment, of course, and this is not just it's not a Portugal story, it's not a Lisbon story, it's a Europe story, it could be a global story, but this is one which is very much probably tied to particularly to Lisbon, and this is housing prices, and here you have a housing boom going on, many people raising question marks as to how much longer can this run. But there's something quite striking in this market. You also have some of the lowest salaries and lowest minimum wage within all of the EU. You're talking about 760 euros a month. And when they're saying that the average rental price now in Lisbon is 2,000 euros a month, this is really causing points of pain, of course, for residents. And also becomes a bit of a sticking point because you have the French, the Americans, the Germans, the Brits, the Swiss, who are all moving to Lisbon. Some, part of it is driven by property speculation, and of course you can still pick up quite fantastic apartments and almost small palaces for a very good price compared to the rest of Europe. But at the same time, of course, this also just raises questions. What should the government be doing to cool things down, or nothing? This is the state of the market. But it's the other conversation, though, is that a lot of people are going or arriving in Portugal right now. I think aside from quality of life reasons, or you could say this is tethered to quality of life, and that's also just safety. This is one of the safest countries in Europe. Very low. We don't need to talk about homicide rates, but those are very low. But when it comes to break-ins and petty crime, of course, many things which are a drag on daily life elsewhere in Europe and the world, these are things which really have not hit this country yet. So this is also part of the flight of why people want to be in Lisbon and the surrounding area, because life is pretty good here. So it's not solely driven by, people wanting to buy and flip properties, but also just looking for a better setup.
And also, the authorities in the country need to set up an infrastructure to cope with all these people. Now, going in and out of Lisbon Airport has never been a major headache for me in the past. But if you're going to have all these people coming in, what are the Portuguese thinking about in terms of making space, accommodating all this?
Well, that's a big discussion right now because you have quite an advanced program, and I would say quite a joined up program when it's looking at sort of national rail infrastructure. But the same thing doesn't exist for aviation. Of course, the country has one principal hub, and that's at Portela Airport in Lisbon. I think one of the last great landings in the world. It's not quite what it used to be like at Kai Tak at Hong Kong, but it's not bad because you are almost flying between apartments and lines of washing fluttering in the air. It is pretty exciting, particularly on a windy day coming into the airport. But that airport is beyond capacity right now. In one way, it's fantastic because you're really landing almost in the city center. Since Tegel has closed, it is one of those European airports where you get out past immigration, you jump in a taxi, Emma, and you're in town in 6 or 7 minutes. So in that way, it works. But there are no gates, and it's heaving. So there is a big discussion right now. The government is looking at up to 9 proposals. A special commission has been set up to either scrap Portela altogether and look at something completely fresh somewhere else. Obviously, it's not going to be quite so central, 30, 40, 50 kilometers away from Lisbon. Or do they go for a split strategy? Do they keep Portela? There's a number of Air Force bases close to the city, and the idea might be to, of course, maybe put low-cost traffic and domestic traffic into one airport. Of course, there's not a lot of domestic traffic within mainland Portugal, but that's a big discussion. Deadlines are at the end of this month, and then they will be looking at recommendations quite swiftly, at least first round by come June time.
Finally, I know you need to get back to that donkey, but your next week is quite a lovely weekend in Zurich. You will be back in Zurich next week, won't you?
I will be back in Zurich. It's going to be role reversal next week. I'm back in Zurich for 2 weeks, so we'll have 2 weeks of Monocle on Sunday coming from Zurich. And it's amazing. It's the fifth anniversary of Dufourstrasse next weekend. It's 5 years since trunks were open its doors, since we dusted down the sidewalk, put the chairs out, and really got rolling. Not too long after, of course, this very program launched. So we're going to do a Hanami market. So any of our listeners who are in and around Zurich next Saturday, this will be a full Japanese market celebrating the Sakura cherry blossom season. And we'll have a variety of different vendors, food and drink, all Japanese stallholders from Switzerland, and also a couple of interesting Japanese brands as well. Some wonderful hostesses who are coming over from the late nights of Ginza, who will also be on hand. So it should be a very good one. Then it's off to we go into Salone Madness in Milan. Of course, we'll be broadcasting from there. We'll be at this Switzerland's Pavilion at Salone in the Brera district. And then it's off to the States. It's going to be another Spanish book signing in New York at Rockefeller Center at McNally Jackson's new bookstore. And then the first Monocle Weekender in the United States in Asheville, North Carolina.
We can't wait. Tyler, we'll let you get back to your olive groves, your winery, and give Geronimo a stroke from me. That was our editorial director, Tyler Brillo, on the line from Portugal. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle Radio. Let's bring in our panellists, Latika Burke and Steve Kinnane. Good morning.
Morning.
Right. Any donkey stories that we need to sort of clear the air with, given the fact that we have an editorial director who's clearly been quite taken by our Geronimo.
I'm sorry, I have no donkey related content. I've done many rounds, but never the donkey round. No.
I'm frankly disappointed. But there is that thing actually that struck a chord that, you know, I remember being up in 37,000 feet a few months ago watching Top Gun and bawling like a baby. The fact that
I'm such an altitude crier.
It's a nightmare.
I bawl my eyes out on flights. I feel so embarrassed for the people next to me.
It's incredible.
It's terrible.
Isn't it?
I do it every single time.
I mean, Top Gun, not necessarily a massive tearjerker. I can't imagine what it must have been like to watch an hour and a half about the welfare of a donkey.
Is this seriously a thing? I have no idea.
Steve,
that you cry on the plane.
How do you not cry on planes?
Well, maybe I'm not watching the right things. Or maybe I'm just not emotional.
I will cry in the happy movies. Like, it's definitely
a thing. Okay, I'm going to monitor this from now on.
I would imagine that, you know, being both from Australia, you would be no strangers to a long haul flight.
Oh God!
Correct.
Oh, all the time.
I
must have cried a lot and not realised it. I'm going to have to recheck my steps here.
Mm. My worst one was when I decided to watch back to back. It was The Theory of Everything, and what's the wonderful one about Alan Turing?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you're too busy crying.
A Beautiful Mind.
No, that's the other one.
No. Oh, gosh, it's completely in red.
I'll look it up.
Oh, sorry, that is the other one. Sorry, I've got it wrong. But that is a great film, that Alan Turing film.
And I just cried the entire flight there was one leg between Sydney, I think, and Dubai, where I just cried the entire time.
Right, so I've just looked at the internet. It's just helped. And if you are a psychologist or an aviation expert, my apologies, I've just Googled it. High altitude and cabin pressure reduces oxygen in the cabin, which causes dehydration. Dehydration is associated with symptoms including mood disturbances and fatigue, which makes you feel sad or become tearful.
Also, it's actually just the dehydration.
Yeah, have a glass of water and get over it.
Interesting. So now I'm such a cryer that I kind of look forward to the cry that I know I'm going to have on the plane. So I get ready.
Just get it all
and
out.
And then I prepare what films I'm going to watch. Like, what's that real tearjerker I've been putting off? Okay, here we go.
So if you basically find yourself next to a woman who's wailing on an aircraft heading for Australia, she's Latika Burke. Whereas clearly Steve is excellent at keeping hydrated.
Yeah, I'll just be there like an Easter Island statue and no one will be none the wiser.
Sipping water and looking smug. Brilliant. Okay, so what stories have we picked for today? Or should we just talk about crying on planes? What do you fancy? Steve, let's bring you in on this one because you've had quite a week involving Julian Assange, haven't you?
Yes, I went to Belmarsh Prison. I can't get in because I'm a journalist, but
we're quite pleased that you can't get in. Not necessarily the right people go into Belmarsh Prison.
No, it's a high security prison in southeast London. Julian Assange is there. I went there simply to cover the NGO Reporters Without Borders going in. They were going to be the first ever NGO to go in and see Julian Assange. They weren't allowed in. The governor denied them access, and they had it all organised. So they were quite outraged, and they gave a media conference in the car park. And while I was in the car park, and as we know from all the president's men, we do some of our best work in car parks as journalists, I found out that the High Commissioner, Stephen Smith, the Australian High Commissioner to the UK, was visiting Julian Assange that day. And we knew that he was going to go in because he told us the week before. And that meant he was the first Australian High Commissioner to visit Assange in prison. And tomorrow is the fourth anniversary of Julian Assange going into Belmarsh.
Just remind us why he's there.
Because he's awaiting extradition to the US, where he's facing, I think it's 18 charges, about 17 of which are espionage related, and I think another is about sourcing information. And this goes back to WikiLeaks publishing hundreds of thousands of military, diplomatic, government, top secret documents, and the US wants to extradite him. And the former Home Secretary to the UK, Priti Patel, approved that, and at the moment he is awaiting appeals relating to that permission to extradite him to the US.
What was it like interviewing Reporters Without Borders in the car park of Belmarsh Prison? What was the reason that they had been given by the governor that they couldn't get in?
That they were journalists. And they're not journalists. They're an NGO. They represent press freedom issues. And in fact, Rebecca Vincent, who is one of the representatives of Reporters Without Borders who was there, has never been a journalist. She used to be a diplomat. So they're not journalists, but that's what they were told. And in fact, Julian Assange, later on, when he met with Stephen Smith, the High Commissioner, asked Stephen Smith to help allow him to get access, to have Reporters Without Borders get access to him in prison.
Latika, this is one of those stories that, dare I say it, has gone away in the United Kingdom. I mean, 4 years, when we realised that it was 4 years since Julian Assange had been sent to Belmarsh, I think, obviously, given the COVID time gap that we all experienced, that suddenly just someone with them went, this is such a long time that he's been in one of the, if not the most high security prison in the UK.
It's funny, I was talking to a cabbie the other day, and this is a very common response whenever you talk about Julian Assange, when people ask you what you've been covering. And he said, oh, where is he? Is he still here? I thought he was still in the embassy. I mean, it's just completely slipped out of, I think, mainstream radar. And in fact, I know of one TV station, not Steve's, in Australia, where they track...
There aren't any other radio.
They track the ratings. And any time there's a mention of Julian Assange, it just falls off a cliff. So it's very difficult for his family, I think, to stay contemporary in the news when...
Indeed. It's no longer topical. It's no longer relevant to a lot of us because WikiLeaks is a long time ago.
And it's a protracted legal battle, which is never exciting, and it's always difficult to sell news-wise. But the government of Australia has certainly been generating its own headlines and saying exactly precisely what you just said, Emma, which is this has been going on for so long. Whether they're making headway is a different kind of, I think, outcome, don't you think, Steve?
Yeah.
It's very unclear whether they're making any headway at all.
It's certainly unclear to me. Certainly they're making more noise about it. The new Prime Minister of Australia, Anthony Albanese, has described raising it with senior officials in the US. I think we can assume that it means President Biden.
Yeah.
And we have a High Commissioner here now who has gone and visited Julian Assange in prison. And what I was told after that visit, that Julian Assange did ask what progress had been made to bring the matter to a close. Now, we don't know what Stephen Smith said in return to that, because he said he won't discuss what happened in that meeting. But you've also, so you've got a Prime Minister who's saying enough is enough. You've got a High Commissioner visiting him. You've also got, which I think is an interesting aspect to this, is Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister to Australia, of Australia, and the former Foreign Minister, is about to become Australia's ambassador in Washington. And I suspect he will be lobbying the US government about the release of Julian Assange too. Now, when Kevin Rudd was Foreign Minister, he made the point that he believed the blame for what got published via WikiLeaks, these hundreds of thousands of documents, including all those cables, diplomatic cables, that the blame lied with the US and the person who leaked them to Julian Assange. Now, we subsequently have worked out that that is Chelsea Manning. Chelsea Manning is free now. And Kevin Rudd was basically saying, well, if you're going to put Julian Assange up for trial or leave him in prison, well, what about the newspapers who published the same information? So I do think that that is significant too, that Kevin Rudd is going to be in DC. If he's not there now, he will be there pretty soon, and he'll be the ambassador, and he will probably be speaking up about this.
It's that perpetual story, isn't it? There is one man in prison in London and yet the whole his whole fate will be decided about who's in which office, where and when. And the fact that we've had changes in government in Australia, we've got Anthony Albanese in there. Is there a sense that perhaps Albanese will be fighting a little bit harder for Assange, or that you know, that the relations between the US and Australia, very good at the moment, it could actually make something happen here?
That is the hope from the Australian side, certainly. But it's interesting to note what the foreign the Foreign Minister Penny Wong says, which is something very different, slightly nuanced, but it is quite different. And she was asked about this only the other week. And she says, look, we can't interfere in other countries' legal processes. And it's important to remember that this has been brought, yes, under the former Trump administration, but by the Department of Justice in the US, which is independent of government. And there is a concern that has been expressed that if Australia were successful in saying to the US government, get this case dropped, well, what kind of precedent would that set for other investigations, i.e. Trump? So it's a little more complex, and I think that Penny Wong pointing out that the Australian government cannot be expected to interfere in other countries' rule of law and their legal processes, I think that is a significant counter.
But there will be moments, won't there, Steve, that we've got Biden going to Australia in May, haven't we?
In May, that's right.
So what do you think might happen then, if anything? I mean, will it just be a two-minute conversation on the sideline?
It's really hard to know what will happen behind closed doors, but I think in before Biden gets there, there's going to be a bit of noise created by free speech and press freedom advocates. I've got no doubt about that, that they'll be putting pressure on Biden to drop the charges or to do something about dropping the charges. And bear in mind, this is happening in the context of Evan Gersovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter in Moscow, who's just been charged with espionage by Russia. Now, this is put, I think this puts the US in a very awkward situation in that they're rightfully campaigning to drop these charges because they're just completely fabricated and made up, but they are pursuing Julian Assange under espionage, and he is being pursued for publishing state secrets that have come from the US. And it's very important that, you know, there's a lot of talk about values at the moment from Western leaders when it comes to Russia and China and an idea of united values. And Rishi Sunak had recently commented on China and the UK and how values are different. Issues around freedom of speech are really important for the West. And I mean, I was just recently talking to the opposition leader from Belarus, who is now in exile in Lithuania. And in that country at the moment, there are 33 journalists locked up. And it's really important that the West has its own house in order when it comes to issues around free speech if they're going to be campaigning in other countries.
We also have the fact that this is...
I'm a little sceptical about whether that argument will have any weight in Washington, because it's very clear that they do not view Julian Assange as a journalist. And this was central to the first legal proceedings here in the UK where his extradition was being examined and eventually approved and ordered. And they argue that by dropping all those cables unredacted, this is the key, unredacted online, that was not the work of a journalist. And actually, when you go and look at when the Times, The Guardian, all the media outlets were collaborating with WikiLeaks, they did it very carefully to ensure that what they were publishing was in the public interest and they didn't expose sources and people's identities. Now, when those documents were put up unredacted, that is what the US government, certainly in its legal arguments, have been using to say, this is why this guy is different. This is why he's not a journalist. And actually, that was accepted by the UK judge who ordered, eventually, the court eventually ordered his extradition.
I think whether he's a journalist is irrelevant. I don't think he's a journalist. I think he's a publisher. Daniel Ellsberg was not a journalist when the Pentagon Papers were published. It's about these are very complicated issues, but that's the line that the US is pursuing. And look, what they want to make sure is no one ever does this again. Mm-hmm. That's what they're doing, and that's why they're challenging it every way. They want to show this as a way. They want to show this as an example of this is what you do. This is what the consequences are if you publish information in a reckless fashion, in their view. And look, I do. I had problems about issues too, and particularly protecting people who could have been at risk of being killed or tortured or detained or whatever in certain countries where these cables related to and they were giving information to the US. So look, you know, I think there was a degree of recklessness about how some of these things were being published, but there are still principles at stake here.
What role does the British government play in all this? Because, you know, he is on British territory in a British prison. It is a decision that was made by the previous Home Secretary to allow the deportation process to go ahead. We are currently being governed by a government which is arguably even more right, well, the Home Secretary is even more right-wing than the previous.
They've become progressively right-wing, well, haven't they? Because it was first Sajid Javid, then Priti Patel, and now Suella Braverman.
We thought Priti Patel was hardcore, and then Suella Braverman just like, hold my beer, off I go.
Yes.
I mean, does Britain have any role in this other than just giving him bed and board until they can get him on the plane?
It's hard to know. I'm not sure whether they could reverse the decision given as a new Home Secretary, because there are appeals before the courts and they may have to let them all play out. So perhaps they could reassess after those court cases are dealt with. I'm not sure about that. But it was a decision made by the Home Secretary, and there is a new Home Secretary there now.
I would also add here, I've asked Labor about this. In fact, I interviewed David Lammy a couple of months ago, and I asked him, would you do anything on this? He said no.
No, because we
so
also
even haven't... if there's a change of government, I don't think you would see any change in the government government's position on it.
And the Labor leader, Sir Keir Starmer, is former Director of Public Prosecutions. This will be a man who is incredibly keen to see justice done in the most straight way possible, won't he?
Yeah, that's true.
Not great news for Julian Assange. Right, the time here in London is 9:31. You're with Monocle on Sunday. Let's head to Helsinki now to our correspondent Petri Burtsov to find out what's happening in his neck of the woods. A very good morning to you, Petri, and happy Easter.
Happy Easter, Emma. Great to talk to you.
My goodness, you've got more energy than an Easter bunny after 40 eggs. Good to hear you, Petri. I'm glad to hear that it's all going well in Helsinki. Now, normally when you join us on festive weekends, you sort of like found yourself a very beautiful, quiet spot, possibly near a little bit of woodland, definitely near some water, surrounded by calm. Not the case this Easter, I'm afraid, is it?
No, unfortunately not. So yeah, we usually go to the family's summer homes. It's sort of officially the opening of the summer season, although the weather is far from summery yet. It's about plus 10, but sunny. But this year, sadly, I had to pass on that. I've been feeling a little bit under the weather. I think it's the reason of... I was recently, earlier this week in Switzerland, doing a report for Monocle, and I did a little bit too much of Swiss wine tasting, so I've had to take it a bit easier this Easter.
I mean, seriously, I don't know. I'm not going to pry too much about the state of your liver, but frankly, that you had so much fun in Switzerland, you can't actually take a restorative break in the countryside. I mean, and well done for making it to the radio this morning. Frankly, you must be congratulated. But what on earth were you doing to yourself, Petri?
I don't know. It's a tough job, but you know, somebody has to do it. You can read more about it in Monocle's upcoming Art Basel newspaper.
We can't wait. Right, Petri, sort of having gathered yourself together, and I'm assuming you've had a nice strong coffee to get yourself going, bring us news from where you are. We had a big change in government this week, and we had the departure of Sanna Marin.
Yes, it's been really quite an eventful week in Finland. I think it's the first time that I remember that Finland has been sort of number one item on even the global news agenda for some days. So let's get going on this one by one. So yeah, first we had last weekend, exactly a week ago on Sunday, we had an election. Of course, the Sanna Marin's center-left government suffered a very clear defeat in the elections. And then this week, Sanna Marin officially resigned, both as prime minister. That was to be expected, of course, after having lost the election. But she also resigned as the leader of the Social Democrats, which is really, really interesting. And there's a lot of speculation going on in Finland, you know, given Sanna Marin's sort of, I think it's fair to say, global superstar status. I mean, she was on the cover of the Time magazine. So many in Finland are contemplating what Marin's next move will be. It looks very clear that she will not continue in any prominent role in Finnish politics, at least.
Why do you think that is?
That's a very good question. I think this often happens in former prime ministers who are voted out. You know, it's once you've had the top job, it's really, really difficult to sort of just return to the parliament, you know, as a sort of a normal MP once you've had all the power. I don't actually, in my memory, I don't recall any cases of this taking place. But then also, I think she's really... aware of the fact that she's actually a lot more popular abroad than she is in Finland, and she wants to sort of ride on that wave of popularity.
So you picked the wrong week to be out of Finland, didn't you, Petri? Because not only did you lose Sanna Marin, Finland was embraced into the bosom of NATO.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So this actually is funny. This happened when I was in Switzerland, embarking on this serious journalism that I mentioned earlier. And it happened on Tuesday. Finland became officially the 31st member of NATO, and it's interesting now looking at this first week of having been a NATO member, how the public debate has sort of shifted now, or started to shift at least, because, in the run-up to Finland joining, the debate and the public discussion was almost exclusively about the benefits of the membership. But now, we have already started to discuss what the membership means in terms of responsibilities and how it changes sort of the whole Finnish defense paradigm. And we've heard some critical voices as well.
What were they saying?
So, for example, we heard, I just actually read this interview with a famous and well-known international relations professor, Teuvo Teivainen, in this morning's sort of news from the Finnish broadcasting company YLE, and he was already saying that, we need to take a really hard look at the concessions that Finland and actually by extension Sweden made to Turkey in terms of the sort of declining to support the Kurds, and also in Helsinki the police blocked a demonstration against the Turkish president Erdogan, and Teivainen, the professor, is saying that, what if this was China or Russia instead of Turkey, and the Finnish authorities sort of moved in to block this demonstration, how would it look? And they also interviewed the head of Finland's Amnesty International, Frank Johansson, who also said that, this does not look good for Finland's human rights record.
It's a difficult moment, isn't it? Because it sort of changes Finland's military identity and the relationship, the long-held relationship it had with Russia, that sort of arm's length neutrality, which isn't quite neutrality. I mean, are you sort of scratching your heads and wondering, what your relationship with your neighbour is going to be now?
Yes, absolutely. That's future will only show. But I think there's a wide consensus in Finland that this sort of defense doctrine or thinking about Finnish and Russian relations is not valid anymore since Russia has started to invade its neighboring, its sort of non-militarily aligned neighboring countries. And there was also we've heard voices from Russia saying that it considers Finland also to belong to its sphere of influence. So, it was clear that Finland could not, keep Russia at arm's length anymore, and something more had to be done. And that was actually the whole background to this significant turnaround in NATO support in Finland.
And one thing that we had Monocle's Marcus Hippi talk to us a few days ago on Monocle Radio about the fact that it could be a bit of a money spinner for Finland because, running along the eastern border of Finland, the possibility of a NATO base could bring in quite a lot of excitement, new fresh voices, new fresh faces, arguably quite a lot of cash as well, and that we should all be buying property quickly along the Finnish border. Have you signed up yet to anything?
I haven't yet, since we have this summer home, but maybe I can sell the summer home in the islands to you, Emma, and I can start looking for a summer home by a nice lake. Finland's biggest lake, Saimaa, is actually in the eastern Finland. It's really, really lovely scenery. I would be happy to move there.
Okay, I'm just going to ask my studio guests as well. Steve and Latika, are we all going to up sticks and move to the Russian border to buy ourselves a nice house by a lake?
Well, I've never been into property speculation, so I'm not starting now. But I do think it's pretty interesting that the border, NATO's border with Russia, has just doubled in one decision, and that is a very significant geopolitical shift.
And it was something that arguably Vladimir Putin was the last thing that he wanted to happen.
Well, he's become the recruiter-in-chief for NATO, hasn't he, really? And Sanna Marin, when she took over as prime minister, said there's no way that they would join NATO. It's such a radical shift.
It is a huge change.
I think we call it an own goal. From Putin, of course.
Petri, let's move on. So after major political shifts, obviously one of the burning subjects that's happening in Paris this week was a vote by Parisians against the e-scooter. Finns have been experiencing the same sort of like heart-wrenching about e-scooters where you are as well. But you're slightly more welcoming than the French, aren't you?
Yeah, that's correct. So this was basically just decided. It still has to be confirmed, I think, by the city council. But in Helsinki, the city officials have decided to keep allowing the e-scooters. There's around 15,000 of them. So just, you know, putting into context, Helsinki is a city of 500,000 people and 15,000 rentable e-scooters. But they've basically decided to continue allowing their use, but they now want them to be parked only in designated parking spots in the city center. And the backdrop to this is that you know, similar trials have worked in Norway, for example. But you know, on the other hand, in order to create these designated parking spaces for e-scooters, they've had to take parking spots from cars, which is already very limited space in the center of Helsinki. So it's an interesting move because it's, on one hand, it's popular because a lot of people really don't like these e-scooters, but you know, a lot of people also dislike the fact that it's really impossible to park your car in the center of Helsinki. So I'm a little bit skeptical. I mean, I see these e-scooters left all over the place, and I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. I'm just skeptical. You know, will people really all of a sudden be really responsible and park them in a tidy line somewhere in a designated parking spot?
It's not just that you're untidy with them, but you keep falling off them as well. It's an expensive business riding an e-scooter in Finland. You keep injuring yourselves.
That's right. Yeah, there's been hundreds of accidents. I saw that the Helsinki University released some numbers that accidents involving electric scooters cost more than 1.7 million euros to the taxpayers last year. So, you know, it, not in, only in terms of money, but of course, you know, health risks as well. Hundreds of accidents.
Finally, very quickly, we've got the Eurovision Song Contest coming up quite soon, and Finland's entry, we don't have a copy of it to play today, but I'm sure we'll try and find it. Or whether we do want to or not is up for debate, because apparently everyone thinks it's awful.
Yeah, I hope Fernando is listening, because this is really interesting. So Finland has really high hope for its candidate called Kärjä this year. And it's really unique music. It's kind of a combination of Euro rap and trash metal. And it's like, it sounds awful, yes, but it gets you in a good mood. And BBC did I think it came out yesterday, they did a review of all the entries to Eurovision, and BBC's Eurovision expert Mark Savage, he called Kärjä, I believe he said that it sounds like a spoon in a blender, only less melodic.
Brilliant. We can't wait. Petri Bertsov, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle on Sunday. It's 9:44 here in London. You're back with Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson, joined around the table by Steve Kinnane and Latika Burke. Welcome back. Latika, you wanted to talk about Emmanuel Macron's trip to China.
It's been a very big week, I think, for China, Freudian slip, China-EU relations, should I say, because, of course, China's goal here is to try and fracture the relationship between Europe and the United States, which is getting closer and, I think, deepening and becoming more aligned since the war and also since the pandemic. And so it was very closely watched, this state visit of Macron's to Beijing this week. Macron asked von der Leyen to accompany him for some of that trip. She did, but her schedule was very notably scaled back and very lean compared to the lavish ceremony put on for Macron over 3 days.
She got 45 minutes.
Yes, Macron got 6 hours. Exactly. And boy, wasn't he telling everybody who would listen about how in his view, put France on the table and on the geopolitical space compared to the rest. And there is a sense amongst China watchers that he has done a lot of damage with this visit. He has played into Xi's hands and contributed to what could be a way for China in on the EU relationship, which, of course, Germany is the big exporter to China, followed by France. The rest of the EU doesn't actually export very much to China. And that's why you've seen von der Leyen coming out and saying we shouldn't be decoupling. That's obviously a bit of a shot at the US, which wants full decoupling. We should be de-risking. And I think that's the smarter strategy. But we saw Macron going over there signing a myriad of business deals, selling Airbus planes to the Chinese, and completely, some would say, selling out the EU. I wouldn't personally put it that far, but I think that Macron's visit was not helpful.
You've got to give it to Emmanuel Macron, haven't you, to sort of take 50 business delegates with him for a trip which essentially was intended, well, I think many people assumed, would be the moment when Emmanuel Macron sat Xi Jinping down and went, you know, your 12-point plan to end the conflict in between Russia and Ukraine, you need to ask Ukraine about this first and you need to bend Putin's ear. And yet, no, we got Airbus deals instead.
Yeah, and it's not a that 12-point plan is not a plan. It's a collection of motherhood statements and talking points. It's no real plan to end the war in Ukraine. I think it was significant that Emmanuel Macron took dozens of business leaders along with him. Ursula von der Leyen had recently given a speech talking about the importance of restrictions on trade with China, particularly relating to sensitive technologies. He got the full banquet. Ursula did not. I think Emmanuel probably needs a good feed after his favourite restaurant was torched in Paris.
He won't fit into those suits.
No, but they were obviously duchessing him and rewarding him. And yes, it was a different message, wasn't it, from what was coming from the EU and what was coming from France.
And it doesn't just play into the trying to fracture relationships between Europe and the United States, does it, Latika? Because if you have Xi Jinping sitting there thinking, OK, I'm going to have Olaf Scholz come and visit me, and I'm going to have Pedro Sanchez from Spain coming to visit me, and I have Emmanuel Macron coming to visit me, I can now deal with individual countries instead of having to deal with a bloc, which is something that China does not wish to do, does
it? Absolutely. That is their goal. That's their intention. They would much prefer to deal with these countries bilaterally than as part of a bloc. And European unity will need to be very strong, I think, on this front if they are to have any success. I think the real question, though, is what did Europe get out of Xi? It's very unclear. I don't see any commitment from Xi to interfere in the war in Ukraine. My understanding is China, that, you know, the Europeans were told that China does not see itself as involved in this war. It has no stake and it won't be getting involved. So if we have no outcome on that, what about Taiwan? Well, Xi's own words were to Macron that, well, accidents could happen. And then we see these military drills sent over Taiwan, the strait, over the weekend. So I think there was a great deal of alarm from the European side about just how deteriorated the relationships between China and the rest of the world, or the West, really are. A very serious decay has gone on. And I think when the history is being written and studied by the children of the future, I think they will look to the pandemic as the moment when China sealed itself off the world and really contributed itself to these deteriorating relationships as well.
It's reshaping its role in the world in quite an astonishing way, isn't it? Because we have now, it is impossible for us to unpick the deep relationship, the deep trade relationship that the rest of the world has with China. If we stopped importing stuff from China, we would have no stuff. It's as simple as that. So we are dependent on China for that. Then you see China and all the long-term inroads with not just Belt and Road, but the huge amounts of investment that it's made in the likes of Africa, which has been well documented, making, you know, drawing African countries more into the Chinese sphere of influence. And then you have the fact that China is now trying to say, we will be in charge of ending the war in Ukraine. We will be in charge in bringing, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia back together. So China is basically recalibrating almost every area of geopolitics in its own image.
And when's President Xi actually picking up the phone and calling President Zelensky? I mean, I thought this was meant to happen straight after his visit to Moscow. And China's very keen to be saying that they're not taking sides, but he's just had a two-day visit with President Putin. And China is benefiting out of what is going on at the moment. They're now getting cheap energy supplies from Russia, and deals were done about that when President Xi went to Moscow. And Macron did raise, when are you going to call Zelensky? But he still hasn't called him.
He could have said, look, we're here together. Here's my phone. I've got the number.
Yeah, let's just
do it now.
Number.
Let's just sit down together. let's just do this now. You could literally have said, okay, well, look, while I've got you, let's just, I've got him on speed dial. Here you go. You know, Emmanuel passes the phone over to Xi. Here's Volodymyr. Have a word. Doesn't even happen.
No.
It is incredible. In terms of the relationship between Australia and China, how is that? That's had a really bumpy time in the last couple of years. And it's a, you know, it's a difficult path for Anthony Albanese to tread, isn't it?
It's having a renaissance, shall we say. So the new government took very much an issue with the tone of the former government and its rhetoric on China. They came into government and spoke much more softly about China, although didn't change anything policy-wise. And as a result, China has rewarded this government. They've allowed the foreign minister to go on visit late last year, and there's an expectation that there'll be a prime ministerial visit later this year as well, although I don't think that's necessarily so unusual now that we're seeing all these foreign leaders go to Beijing again. It's funny, though, I was talking to somebody the other day who said, you know, before we used to have to justify, we used to have to justify why we weren't going to China for visits, for state visits. Now we're having to justify why we're going to China for state visits, which I think is a really neat kind of underlining of the point that I was making earlier about just how much has changed and I think really deteriorated. But Australia, I think, is getting back on track with China, but there is certainly a deep scepticism about future trading relations, given we saw how quickly and suddenly China could just bring down the guillotine on certain trades and cut them off when it got angry.
And it's not completely unbumpy. I mean, we've just had the AUKUS deal, which China described as an arms race in the Indo-Pacific. So, you know, there's certainly, Latika is right that they're talking to each other again, which is very different to what it was under the last government, but it's still a bit fractious.
You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. I'm joined in the studio by Latika Burke, journalist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and by Steve Kinnane, Europe Bureau Chief for ABC, an Australian land grab. Steve, I know you're keen to talk about Bruce Haig, a name that perhaps won't ring very loudly around the world, but should.
Yeah, a really good mate of mine has just died on Good Friday, age 77. He was an Australian diplomat in South Africa in the 1970s. He was a young man in his early 30s. He was the first foreign diplomat to get in touch with Steve Biko, the head of the Black Consciousness Movement, who was killed in detention, beaten to death by South African security services in 1977, I think it was. Of course, anyone who's familiar with the film Cry Freedom, based on Donald Woods's book, Biko, about Steve Biko and what happened to him, should know about Bruce, because Bruce, there's a character in Cry Freedom played by the Australian actor John Hargraves called Bruce, who was a journalist. Now, they had to mask who Bruce really was. Bruce was a diplomat. We had to all hide this for years, that Bruce was using the diplomatic car. He smuggled Donald Woods out of South Africa. He helped plan and execute the plan to get Donald Woods out. And Donald Woods became one of the most important advocates in the world arguing against apartheid.
And, so the journalist Donald Woods is smuggled out of South Africa. They get him into Lesotho, and then that allows him to tell the world about what's going on.
And he has a copy of his manuscript for Biko on him at the time. There was one other copy of that manuscript, and Bruce Haig put it in the Australian diplomatic bag and sent it off to a publisher somewhere else. So it was very important that Donald Woods got out of the country. He had been, they'd seized his passport. They said he couldn't leave the country. He was no longer allowed to publish, and it was really important that that story got out. And that film that came out, it was made by Richard Attenborough. That film had a big influence. Denzel Washington played Steve Biko, and it was once again part of all that worldwide build-up about shining a light what was going on in South Africa and what happened to Biko at that time. And he was an incredible natural leader. Everyone who met him at the time said that about him, and it was a real tragedy that he died in the way. And that was a really important thing to do. And you don't hear stories of that, of a diplomat doing that kind of work inside a country like that.
Indeed, I think a lot of the tributes, especially a really lovely article in The Guardian, which very, very fulsomely sort of talks about the importance of Bruce Haig. He said the only Australian diplomat to have used his immunity to help black activists opposing apartheid. It really puts a focus on what the role of a diplomat is, isn't it? Doesn't it?
Yeah, and there's a quote here from Bruce, I might read, actually, where he said, Apartheid was a system of governance that grossly defied the norm. It challenged the diplomatic approach of being even-handed. I decided that you were either for it and the fundamental evil that it represented, or you were against it. And if you were against it, you had to do something.
We need more of those, don't we?
Yep.
Finally, massive handbrake turn. Natika Burke, I know you want to talk about musicals because you're such a fan.
Well, I do love going to musicals, but there's some in London that I'm absolutely steadfastly refusing to go to because I've heard such terrible stories about people who cannot behave themselves getting up and drinking through the show and then at the end singing along, which I think is an absolute crime.
How could you dare
against
have fun?
Musical theatre? No. Well, it's all reached a crescendo in Manchester last night when the finale of The Bodyguard, which has been playing at the Palace Theatre there, was ended in riots and women being forcibly ejected when they tried to sing I Will Always Love You over the performer. The whole show actually had to end early, and there is absolutely crazy footage of security guards, quote, storming the venue. I'm not sure I would use that word, but taking very rowdy theatre goers out and causing and prompting a very sorry apology. I'm not sure that she had to give it from the lead singer that she couldn't finish the show.
It's super fun. It's Melody Thornton, the former Pussycat Doll.
Yes.
Everybody. Yes, obviously we all knew that. So we do have, it's mainly women, isn't it, who are having, I don't see many men being, well, blokes being pulled out.
I just need to take issue with Latika here.
Go for it.
I would like to, she used the term crime. I would like to describe all musical theatre as a crime.
Oh, Steve,
I think if you perpetuate a crime against a crime than that is allowed. Oh. I am also pro-fun on every different level.
It's
and if people want to get
fun.
Trolleyed and go and sing at a musical, I am all for it. I cannot believe that you've become such a wowser, Latika.
Steve,
you should support this behaviour.
I'm going to take you to Mamma Mia, which
is not.
Where I hear some of the worst crimes of
and
this category
also,
occur.
You cannot stop the people of Manchester from singing. You cannot do that. Otherwise, Noel Gallagher will come round and torch your house.
This is true.
Now, I was one of the most moving moments of my life was in 2017 after the Manchester bombing, and to hear the people of Manchester sing "Don't Look Back in Anger" publicly was so moving.
That was
you cannot stop the people of Manchester singing. I'm all for this behaviour. And how dare those people put notes up saying no singing? Like,
who do they think they are?
Kill those polite notices off.
Professional performers.
I'm from Manchester. I'm not saying anything. Steve Kinnane and Latika Burke, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. And thanks to my guests, Tyler Brilli and Petri Bertsov as well. That's all we have time for today's edition of Monocle on Sunday. The programme was produced by Desiree Bandley and our studio manager was Christy O'Grady. I'm Emma Nelson. Monocle on Sunday returns next week from Zurich. But for now, happy Easter. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.